Hey, architecture firm owners and emerging leaders. Get ready for unparalleled insight into the development of a world-class architecture firm and a worldwide organization driving the digital transformation of the design and construction industry. With Build Smart, the podcast that's changing how our profession operates. We share the incredible stories behind innovation in the building industry with my friend and co-host, Patrick McLamey, FAIA, former CEO of the international architecture firm, HOK.
You know, Yamasaki's office or firm lasted during his lifetime. And when he passed away, I think that was the end of the Yamasaki office. Helmuth did not want that. He wanted a firm that would live out and grow beyond the founders.
In season one, discover the untold stories behind HOK's meteoric rise from 150 employees in St. Louis to a powerhouse with over 1,900 staff members and 27 offices worldwide.
You know, they weren't as polite as the Kojima people. That was just boom. And anytime you have a creditor, whether it's Kojima or the bank, that wants their money, unless you can raise money someplace else, you are out of business.
Bankrupt.
Bankrupt.
And hold on tight for season two, where Patrick takes us on a new adventure as chairman of Building Smart International, shaping the future of digital transformation in the design, construction, and operation of built assets.
Ian Howell, Ken Harold, and I, Ken was my technical representative from HOK. The three of us took a tour of Europe of 5 cities in 5 days. Very busy time.
Simply follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Smart now and uncover lessons that will transform you and your architecture firm.
Architecture is dead. This is the Entrepreneur Architect Podcast with Mark R. LePage, Episode 1. Inspiring your everyday success in business, leadership, and life. It's finally here, episode 1 of the Entrepreneur Architect Podcast. My name is Mark LePage, and I am so excited to finally get this thing off the ground and start sharing some great interviews with some really interesting and inspiring people. But quick, before we get started, being episode one and all, I want to quickly thank a few people. First, I want to thank my lovely wife, Anne-Marie McCarthy. She is my partner at Five Cat Studio and mom to my kids. And she is the best partner I could have in both the firm and my family. Anne-Marie has encouraged me and advised me throughout the relaunch of Entrepreneur Architect. And there is no way I'd be doing what I'm doing without her support. So thank you very much, Anne-Marie. Second, my kids. My kids are so proud of what I'm doing here. Their encouragement keeps me going every day. My oldest son is 11, and he has appointed himself my official entree architect advisor. He reviews everything I do and gives me some really valuable feedback. And everything that's been done on the new website has been officially approved by James. So thank you very much, James, for your help. But most of all, I want to thank you, the entrepreneur architects who read my blog and follow me on Twitter and have been waiting so patiently for this podcast to finally launch. Since the relaunch of the website entrearchitect.com, visitors to the blog have quadrupled. That's partly thanks to Bob Orson for my guest post published on his Life of an Architect blog with a link back to Entree Architect. So thank you very much, Bob, for that. And I've been receiving some incredible encouragement and gratitude for what I'm doing here at Entrepreneur Architect. So I thank you most of all. Your kind words have been so very inspiring and motivational. And I'm having such a great time here learning about success in architecture. So here we go. Episode one is an interview with my friend Christopher Pollard. I think you're going to enjoy this. He is the founder and CEO of Anon Design Collective. He's trained as an architect, but as you'll see, he has taken his career in a very different direction. But before we start, I have one quick correction. Chris's firm's name is Anon Design Collective. When I sat down with him to record the interview, my first time recording interview nerves kicked in, and I misstated the name of his firm. So if you want to check him out, the firm name is Anon Design Collective. Here's the interview. I hope you enjoy it. Hey, we're here live at Five Cat Studio, so please forgive this audio and the poor acoustics in this space, but we're here today with a friend of mine, Christopher Pollard. He's the founder and CEO of Anon Design Collaborative. Welcome to the podcast, Chris.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for being here. Anon Design Collaborative, give us a little bit of background on that. Tell us a little bit about what you do. Yeah.
Anon Design sits squarely in the experiential marketing space, particularly or more specifically as an experience design firm that employs a collaborative model. So we are a network of individual design professionals, most of them award-winning, in fact, who represent brand strategy, visual communication design, environmental design, and digital interactive design. And Anon Design Collaborative sits at the kind of intersection of each of those mediums. So we're interested in the collaboration between creative agencies, but we're also interested in the sort of intersection or collaboration of 2D visual communication combined with 3D space, combined with what I refer to as 4D content. And when you integrate each of those seamlessly, you allow a really robust and innovative, strategic, creative design solution to result.
Interesting. So, but you're trained as an architect, right?
Trained as an architect.
So give us a little bit about your education and a little bit of your career before Anon.
Right. So I went to architecture school, a 5-year accredited program at Syracuse University. And I went there under the guise of thinking that architects were actually developers. So I wanted to be an architect to make money.
Surprise.
And very quickly realized that it wasn't the architects that make the money, it's the developers that make the money.
Right.
But I have to say that within the first semester of architecture school at Syracuse, I fell in love with the idea of design. I fell in love with the idea of, more specifically, the design of space and the kind of theories and philosophy behind the creation of space. And committed to the idea of creating architecture. But so I went through a 5-year program and was educated by some unbelievable minds within that university program.
It's a very design-focused program.
Hardcore modernist program. So a lot of focus on modern architecture and the principles behind modern architecture and space making, but more specifically, I think the idea of place making, and that's what I really found intriguing about that education, was this idea of place making, and it was a tremendous education, and I think I real time was understanding that this education was very, very different from the education of my peers, the majority of which were not architecture majors. They were management majors. They were whatever.
The
they were regular college type, students, right. Correct. And I became aware that I was in the midst of a very different kind of education. And that it was an opportunity to take advantage of that. And there's some extremely unique qualities of an architectural education that that transcend architecture, quite right. honestly.
Right. So where did you go once you left Syracuse, once you graduated?
So I graduated, and quite honestly, I was so sick of architecture school and all those wonderful professors pontificating.
Right.
that I sold surfboards on Cape Cod for
very cool.
6 months and had a great time.
So you took a break.
I did.
With the intent of
continuing
architecture, but
correct.
You needed some time off.
Yes, I needed time off, and I needed time to just allow what I had learned over the last 5 years to kind of sort itself out in my mind and where I wanted to go with it. I knew from a very early time within architecture school that I didn't really want to be an architect in the traditional sense. And I think that was born out of a happy accident, maybe, that my roommate freshman year just happened to be one of my best friends from high school. We just both happened to go to Syracuse together. But he was a Newhouse major, communications major, more specifically advertising. And the Newhouse School at Syracuse is a brilliant school within the university. And he and I used to have these alcohol-fueled debates and conversations about advertising and the future of advertising. And I used to talk to him about the fact that I didn't understand why advertising didn't see the three-dimensional world as the next logical dimension of brand communication. It just didn't make any sense to me that the advertising world sat in this flat, disengaged media. 2D print ads, radio spots, television commercials, you know, all of these things just sort of speak at you, not with you. And I would talk about how the next logical dimension in advertising and therefore, you know, marketing was the extrusion of a 2D brand message into three dimensions. And so it got me very interested in this idea of how architecture could become a new medium.
So you knew that pretty early on.
Fairly early on. I speak about it now I had this master plan.
Sure.
It certainly wasn't right. that.
But the seeds were there.
There, yes. I had an interest. I had a kind of an itch about pulling architecture out of architecture and using it as a vehicle to address other challenges or opportunities or what have you. So
where did you go from there?
Yeah. So I after selling my last surfboard, I got back in touch with a very good friend of mine, a professor of mine that I really respected. At Syracuse, and told him I was moving to New York City, and he and I had a very good relationship in architecture school, and I think he understood that I wasn't the average student there, and he made a tremendous recommendation to give David Rockwell a phone call. David is also a graduate of Syracuse University School of Architecture, and this professor was aware of what the Rockwell Group was doing and said, you know, there'd be probably a very good fit there. So
and that's not a traditional architecture firm, right? I mean,
no, not at all. Not at all.
So how was it being in that kind of environment? I mean, is that kind of take those seeds and start helping them grow a little bit being there?
Yes. I knew from the minute I walked into that firm for my interview with David, that it was a very different place. They were in the process of designing three of the hottest nightclubs in New York City. The themed restaurant kind of industry was just taking off, so they were designing all the Planet Hollywood restaurants around the world. And within 5 minutes, a whole new world of architecture, quote unquote, was presented to me.
Right.
Never once in architecture school did anybody talk to me about designing a nightclub.
Right. And the way Rockwell Group designs them, they're it's more than just architecture.
Absolutely.
It's all about marketing.
It's the brand.
The space of
yes.
the brand of that
yes.
space.
So there was, I was very intrigued, and I knew that this place, that our, you know, and I'm, again, I'm not going to put myself on the same level as David at this point by any means, but I could believe in the philosophy behind that firm and the vision
right.
behind
right.
that firm. And what I found fascinating about it was, you know, and I will always respect David for this, that he has a very strong vision about his style of architecture. I hate using that phrase, but he believed in the idea of the theatricality of architecture, and that the creation of temporary space, or space and experience that allows the suspension of real life or everyday life, is just as valid as creating institutional architecture that's theoretically important and will remain in perpetuity. And I appreciated his point of view on that, that architecture is one of those mediums that can transport people from reality to fantasy.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with that. As a matter of fact, there needs to be more of that in the world.
Right.
So it was a place that very early on I felt really comfortable in. There was a shared philosophy there, and was given a tremendous amount of opportunity there, and allowed me to continue this kind of exploration of where architecture could go beyond architecture in a traditional sense.
And you were there for a while, right?
I was. I was there for 6-7 years. In my my first stint.
You did two rounds.
I did
there, right?
two tours.
So, tell us a little bit about that. Why did you leave?
Yeah.
And then why did you come back?
Yes. So I was there for seven years the first time. And I left the first time because I felt I had reached my potential there. Not that the firm in any way, shape, or form was a limiting factor. It was, I had achieved what I needed to achieve in that time period. And I knew that if I wanted to continue to pursue this idea of marketing and advertising meeting architecture, I had to find a new way to do it, and was given the opportunity to leave the architecture profession proper and take a job within a large entertainment company called Clear Channel Entertainment, which has now become Live Nation, and was given an opportunity to join a very kind of forward-thinking collection of advertising, marketing, and design professionals who sat inside this large entertainment company to help develop brand experiences for sponsorship programs around live music or live entertainment, more specifically.
Right, so those seeds are really growing.
Really growing. And what it allowed me to do was to get out of the design world and get into the business world,
right,
and get into the marketing world and understand what brands are looking for, how they think, how they act, how they justify marketing budgets, how they define success, how a business deal is made, how you negotiate a sponsorship deal.
Right.
On and on and on and on.
And still as an architect, as a designer.
As a designer.
Right?
But having, as I said, having this tremendous design education that allowed me to you know, the end of the day, a design education is about learning how to problem solve really complex problems. And it was wonderful for me to be able to sit in a room like this and be presented with complex problems, and quite honestly, be one of the only people in the room who could actually
do it.
Do it. Right. Who could collect the information, synthesize it, and then
is what we do every day.
Talk about how you sort it out, and deliver a solution to meet the challenge. And very quickly, you know, the MBAs in the room and the folks that came from more traditional liberal arts educations or business backgrounds were sort of dumbfounded that a quote unquote architect could not only participate but thrive in this kind of scenario. So I had the opportunity to go and experience the world, the business world, the marketing world, more specifically, outside of the world of design, and it was a tremendous education, and it was a nerve-wracking thing at first. And I'll tell you, the first probably month that I was there, I thought I'd made the worst decision of my life, because I was a you know, fish out of water there for a little while, but it ultimately became a tremendous education and opportunity, and it sort of galvanized my belief that there was an opportunity, dare I say, a need in the marketing world to bring design in as a solution provider.
Right, right. And I think that probably is a huge takeaway for the people who are listening to this podcast, that there's an infinite number of opportunities for architects beyond the traditional architecture firm where we're sitting behind computers and designing buildings.
Absolutely.
I mean, there are places in every company where an architect could thrive.
Yes.
With the education that we have.
100%. And that ability to thrive could be through, you know, executive leadership skills that an architectural education sort of instills in you, all the way over to being a tremendous, you know, solution provider or designer, you know? Right. So, you can apply the skills and the capability very directly in terms of delivering a design product or capability, but you can also use, you know, what you learn in that education in a very abstract way in terms of how you understand, you know, in this education at the age of 18 years old, you are presented with a problem. And you have to create the solution. You have to organize the program. You have to develop a party. You have to develop a rationale for your response to that challenge. And then at the age of 18, you have to expose that thinking and that idea to a group forum.
Right.
You are forced to put it up on a wall and be critiqued by your peers and your superiors.
With the intent of being criticized.
And the greatest education, one of the aha moments for me as an 18-year-old freshman in architecture school was the flip side definition of criticism. Criticism, in my mind at that time, was a negative thing. And what I learned really quickly was that criticism is advice.
Right.
And it can be a tremendously positive thing. So the fact that at a very early age, you are forced to develop a unique idea that is individually yours, you have to be able to verbally and visually communicate that idea. You then have to stand up in front of a group, present that idea, be critiqued, and learn how to accept certain criticism as, I never thought of that, or defend and counter-argue a point. And, you know, that's business.
Right.
Every day. I don't care whether you're, you know, the CEO of Microsoft Corporation or, you know, Mark LePage. Like, you're that's what you do in business all day long.
Right.
So, you know, it's a tremendous education, but and it's just that, and that education can be used in a myriad of ways in the world today, so creatively.
You thrived at Live Nation, and once you kind of got the hang of it and got your place there, you kind of...
It did. We had a great kind of, as I said, this non-traditional group, and we all fed off one another because we came at challenges from uniquely different perspectives, but we're all able to meet in the middle. And out of that came the kind of realization and maybe the inspiration to leave Live Nation and go out and start or co-found our own design firm that was very squarely operating in the space of experiential marketing.
So you've taken what you've learned at Rockwell, added what you've learned at Live Nation, and have launched a new firm with the partner or partners.
Correct. And that firm is still in existence today. It's called Pure Partner by Design. And we were there to meet the needs of companies like Live Nation to deliver strategically creative solutions for brands and marketers, and delivering these solutions through an understanding of how to dimensionalize a brand.
Can you give a specific example of what you did there? You know, a specific project and what you were
doing? Yeah, sure. So in 2005, 2006, I don't know. The launch of Xbox 360 game console, we were hired, or we won a competition to design a 50,000 square foot temporary space for Xbox to launch the Xbox 360 brand at this annual technology event called E3 in Los Angeles. It's a gaming event that they have every year. And we delivered probably the most award-winning design solution inside the experiential marketing industry as a result of fully understanding what that brand stood for and dimensionalizing it in across every dimension, 2D, 3D, and 4D, and delivering an integrated experience, a true brand experience from start to finish, that was ultimately the physical and experiential manifestation of that brand's philosophy and positioning. And what was remarkable about that experience was the ability to collaborate with a number of really smart agencies that were associated with the development of that brand. So we were collaborating with Microsoft Corporation, or Xbox, under the Microsoft umbrella, and a gentleman named Jonathan Hayes, who was leading the charge on launching this product. Very, very smart guy who has spoken at the DMI about that program. But we also got to work with an industrial design firm called Astro out of San Francisco, who did the product design for the console itself. We work with a branding agency, a firm called JDK out of Burlington, Vermont, who is the brand identity and the kind of brand positioning agency. And when the three of us got together and talked about where the inspiration of the form factor for the console itself came from, how that inspiration informed the identity system, the logo, the font, the tone and manner of the voice of that brand. And then we were given the opportunity to take all of that information and translate it into a three-dimensional integrated experience. the result was mind-blowing.
Right.
And to this day, it sort of stands as the perfect case study to explain how design, at the end of the day, is the ultimate killer app for business. And that never in a million years would you have explained to me my freshman year in architecture school that I would design a 50,000 square foot space that, you know,
that was Xbox.
That was Xbox.
Right, it wasn't just a cool place.
Right. That would live for 5 days and then disappear.
Yeah.
And it was remarkable. And, you know, and it continues to be, you know, one of those projects that I refer to a lot because it is the kind of perfect embodiment of how you can take what you know as an architect and apply it in a radically different way than you might ever imagine as a freshman architecture student. You know.
Yeah. So how did you find your way back to Rockwell?
So I was speaking with David when shortly after Lehman Brothers collapsed. But again, this was interesting because my business instincts told me that as a small design firm who was at the time struggling to find new projects, I understood that the future was in collaboration. So there was an opportunity to go out and bring the unique capability or offering that we had to other either design firms or production companies or event marketing agencies who didn't have what we had and bring our capability to their capability and deliver a kind of a more robust offering. So in that conversation, I was given the opportunity to go back to the Rockwell Group and lead a studio there that they were interested in creating to pursue this kind of work, to get into the kind of experiential design space.
And you built and led that group?
Yes. I didn't build it. As a matter of fact, it was a group that resulted from my prior tenure at the Rockwell Group. I had done a number of projects for the Coca-Cola company that were brand experience spaces, primarily in the professional sports realm, inside baseball stadiums and football stadiums for big brands. And I worked on the very first Coca-Cola project that they ever had. And out of that, over time, as the relationship grew, a business partnership was made. There's another great example. There was a business partnership made between the Coca-Cola company and the Rockwell Group. Equity positions, creating a design studio to deliver innovative thinking and solutions for the world's largest brand.
And how long were you there on your second?
I was there for 2 years and ran a very large, very secretive project for said beverage company. And again, had a tremendous experience and as part of that, yet again, found myself in this wonderful collaborative environment where I was creatively directing five globally known design firms within this project. So I was working with Bruce Mao, I was working with Bruce Mao Design, I was working with Imagination, I was working with Pininfarina, I was working with Obscura Digital. And again, we had created this tremendous collaborative effort where each agency was bringing its sort of subject matter expertise to the table and working hand in glove with one another to deliver a business solution for a very large brand. And it just reinforced the idea that I've always had around the power of collaboration, which then led to me wanting to step back outside of...
Right. And you launched Anon.
Correct. And Anon, to provide some clarity, is short for anonymous. Design Collaborative or Design Collective is a philosophy. So the name of this company is based on a philosophy that I have that in the space that we choose to operate in, this experience design space where you're working with brands, it's not about you.
Right.
It's about the brands. And the best partner, the best solution provider out there in the brand world is that partner that remains anonymous and allows the brand to be the hero. And I think, I think more design firms need to understand that and embrace that idea, especially these eponymous design firms.
Yeah, I love that.
So I think, Anon Design Collective is based on a philosophy. It's based on a philosophy that we work in a space that it's about the brands, and that a collaborative or a collective effort between individuals or individual entities, be they design or otherwise, working together is infinitely more powerful than, say, a more traditional advertising agency model who claims to be all things to all people at all times.
Right. And you're most successful when they don't know you were even there.
Correct. Exactly.
Yeah. Interesting. So, yeah. Well, we've also had conversations before. We've done this a couple of times without the mic in front of us.
Yeah.
A lot of our conversations have kind of led to this crisis that we have in architecture and the architectural profession, that there's clearly an identity crisis of what architects are and what we do and
yes.
and how, how they're defined. You've used the term with me in the past, architecture is dead.
Yes.
Could you explain that a little bit and talk about that a little bit?
Sure. It's a polarizing kind of statement, but purposefully so. But to elaborate a bit more, there is a bit of shock value in it. But I suppose what I mean is architect, as the world at large knows it, not architects, the world at large, is over. The definition of architect as the world at large knows it. And,
right.
and the example I use is George Costanza in the Seinfeld episode where he refers to himself as Art Vandelay, the architect. And you know that the millions of audience members who aren't architects immediately conjure an image
right.
of some brainiac sitting behind a drafting table in the wee hours of the morning with a
right.
single lamp on, poring over drawings and the mad scientist, right?
And right, and that's the current brand of
that is
of the architecture
that is the
profession.
Perception of the architecture profession outside of architects,
right?
Right, wrong, or indifferent.
That's it.
That's the perception, and that's what I refer to as architecture is dead. It's time to shift the perception. Architect is a brand, and it needs to be rebranded, needs to be repositioned, and we need to cast a new mold for what being an architect can mean.
Right.
And quite honestly does mean currently, but it's just not being promoted and showcased the way it should be right now. Right. And you know, and I think the architecture industry is in a it's in an identity crisis phase right now, and to a degree, I think it's for a good reason, because I think there are architects out there who are contributing to the identity crisis because they're saying, I am not that.
Right.
I'm not Art Vandelay. Right? Like, yeah. And there's this shift, there's this movement away from that traditional kind of image. And a blurring of the lines between architecture and design. And that's why I think, you know, I feel strongly about that statement that architecture is dead in a good way.
Right.
Right?
And that doesn't mean that the traditional architecture firm is dead.
No.
There's always going to be that need.
Absolutely. Correct.
For architecture firms to design buildings.
Correct.
And so they're not just sterile, you know, engineered
Correct.
Structures, but
Correct.
They're well designed. And so that there's certainly that need for that. But architecture is and can be so much more than that.
So much more. And is moving in that direction. And that's where, you know, I evangelize and speak at design forums about that shift, that opportunity for, you know, architects to step into the business world. You know, I'm gonna make a bit of a leap here, because he's not an architect per se, but Johnny Ive from Yep. Apple, you know, Right. is a huge reason that Apple is what Apple is. And design has made Apple the most valuable brand Right. on the planet. Not some MBA somewhere coming up with a business plan and how do you mill laptops faster in the manufacturing plant. Designers created a brand philosophy, a brand belief, and it's more than just Steve Jobs. And that's the power that design and architects have, is this comprehensive understanding of how people think, of how people interpret place and space, and how objects speak to people, how their place in your life or your business or what have you. And these are powerful business drivers. They're not the touchy-feely, wacky, creative guy
Right.
stuff. These are laser-focused business solutions driven by design response to a challenge or an opportunity.
Right. And Johnny Ives isn't an architect, but he could have been.
He could have been. I mean, he's a designer. And at the end of the day, architects are designers. You know, and I've spoken to you about this as well. You know, I think some of the architecture is dead mentality as well is a sort of call out there for architects to climb down out of their ivory towers in the design community. There's an elitism associated with architecture as well that at times prevents the democratization of an architectural approach to design problems, because there's this sort of isolationist or elitist ideal that architecture rises above graphic design or even digital interactive design or product design or any of these other design professions. And it's just not appropriate anymore. That might have been
Right.
back in the day of the Medici.
And what's very interesting is that those other disciplines are making tremendous more money
Oh, yes.
than architects are making, which is a whole nother interview.
And they're advancing, because they are advancing their role in the business world leap years faster
Right.
than architecture.
Right. So. Well, I mean, entrepreneur architect is dedicated to inspiring success in business, mm-hmm. leadership, and life. As an architect designer who has taken an alternative path, mm-hmm. Do you have any tips or lessons for entrepreneur architects that, that are maybe in that traditional role or just coming out of architecture school and hitting this wall where there's no internships available? Do you have any some lessons for those people?
There's a lot of lessons. You know, for students who are coming out of school now in, into a rough economic situation, it's difficult, but I think the idea that you need to, as a as an individual, you need to allow your personal interest to influence your professional pursuit. Be that in architecture or not. And if it's within architecture, your personal passion, I don't care whether it's snowboarding or wood making or whatever it might be, but your personal passion will play an undeniably important role in your life inside a profession. So how you... it's the difference. My father is a businessman, doesn't have a creative bone in his body. And he asked me a question right after graduation about architecture. He didn't understand architecture. And he asked me a really pointed question. And he said, "Do you think you'll have a career or a job?" And I looked at him and I didn't, at the time, I didn't understand what he was asking me.
Yeah.
But then really quickly, I understood what he was asking me. And I think the difference between the two comes back to what I was just talking about, is this personal interest, this underlying personal interest must play a role in your professional pursuit. You will then have a career, because that personal interest will allow you as an individual to have a point of view on something. And points of view are what the world is all about. Points of view are what leaders have. They have opinions. They have perspectives. They're not afraid to make statements like architecture is dead and then back it up. So the biggest piece of advice I can give, and I don't think it's just for students, I think it's for anybody operating in the creative world.
Yeah, which is what this is all about.
Right. Is to have a point of view, and that point of view must come from somewhere inside you that has nothing to do with making money or I like this guy's design style more than this one. It has to come from you. It will be the driving force that will lead you, or that you will have to catch up to throughout your professional career, whatever that trajectory might be or that path might be. And you know, don't be afraid to create a relationship between, I love video games and I'm in architecture school.
Right, right.
Holy cow. I might be able to go and work for Xbox.
There are opportunities.
Wow.
There. Right.
Who knew?
Right. Right. And I think that's really the biggest lesson is don't be afraid.
Don't be afraid.
And, you know, to not be so tied to being a quote unquote architect in the traditional definition, to be blind to those other opportunities.
Correct.
For architects.
Absolutely.
Well, this has been fantastic, Chris. I appreciate you taking the time
to talk to me
and being on on the Entrepreneur Architect podcast.
I love
this
it.
It's been great.
Wonderful.
Thanks
Thank
a
you.
Lot.
So I wanted to start off the podcast with Chris Pollard for one very specific reason. I want you to understand that architecture is so much bigger than the traditional architecture firm. No, I'm not discouraging you from practicing in a traditional role, but the skills we possess as architects can be used in so many different ways, and we could be doing so many different things. As entrepreneur architects, we should be considering and looking beyond the traditional role of architect to find a life that we are truly meant to live. In the episodes to follow, I'm going to be speaking with some pretty amazing people. People who are passionate about what they're doing and succeeding in many different ways. And I hope that they're going to be teaching us a little bit about everyday success in business, leadership, and life. In the next episode, I'm going to be hanging out with my friend Bob Borson. He's the founder and sole author of the Life of an Architect blog, and we're going to talk a little bit about his role as an architect, and then we're going to dive deep into his great success with lifeofanarchitect.com. So don't miss that. It's going to be a good one. And as some of you may know, this podcast is part of my 12-12-12 project. And if you don't know what a 12-12-12 project is, please listen to my introduction episode of the Entrepreneur Architect podcast, which I launched on December 12th, 2012. In that episode, I explain how I got here, why I launched Entrepreneur Architect, and I describe a little bit about my 12-12-12 project. And in the spirit of 12-12-12, future episodes of this podcast will be uploaded to iTunes on the 12th of each month. That makes it easy, right? As was this one. So add the date to your monthly calendar and don't miss a single episode of the Entrepreneur Architect podcast. And I would love to know what you think of this podcast. So please follow me on Twitter at EntreArchitect or send me an email at mark@entrearchitect.com. And if you like what you hear, this is important, please go to iTunes right now and give the podcast a review and a rating. This will help other entrepreneur architects find the podcast and enjoy future episodes. And one quick thing, sign up for my email list. There's a form on each page of the website at entrearchitect.com. With that list, I share exclusive content and news with my subscribers. My idea for that list is to give a little extra love to those who love me. So please sign up for that today, and I think you'll like that. So, until the 12th, I am Mark R. LePage, and I am an entrepreneur architect. Thanks for listening.
I've mentioned it to my family, but in terms of telling people like, oh yeah, we're doing this, I'm looking for projects, you got anything? Yeah. I'm not there yet because it scares the shit out of me.
Dreaming of launching your own architecture firm? Well, buckle up for a wild ride with Emerging, the podcast that shares what it's really like to start an architecture firm.
Where do we begin? We don't even know what type of business to formalize as. Is it an LLC? Is it an LLP? Like, how are taxes? I mean, the list is astronomical.
Season 1 featured founders Jeffrey, Lexi, and Chris, owners of Level Studio Architecture, are your fearless guides on this unfiltered journey from napkin sketches to a thriving studio.
One evening, stumbled into one last dive, we sat at the bar and pondered our postgraduate futures. Amidst the conversation, a napkin became the canvas for our aspirations, sketching plans and milestones, sealing our heartfelt commitment and shared dreams.
In drawing down dreams on a napkin collectively, that then, you know, in your head, you've rooted like, oh, I'm connected to these people, like, long term.
The process of starting an architecture practice brims with excitement and challenges, demanding meticulous planning, flawless execution, and unyielding resilience.
I kind of hate the term because it's so overly used, but I think everybody knows imposter syndrome. And I think it's so real to this day. I don't know if it's with everybody, but with me, I'm always questioning like, us, can we do this? Are we ready to do this? Are we prepared? Can we do it?
Did we just decide a name?
We did it, guys.
Oh my
the one
God.
That came out of nowhere.
Woo!
It came out of nowhere. I liked it. I saw it.
Ready to turn your aspirations into reality? Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Emerging and chart your own path to architectural success.
Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entre Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entre Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles, and Katie Kangas as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There is a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success.